is a PhD student at Reading and works at the Tate as an archivist as well. And I'm Alison Butler from the University of Reading. And this group of people then has congregated around the Dwoskin Archive, which is a collection of papers and digital materials that came to the University of Reading after Dwoskin's death in 2012. Rachel was actually the executor of the estate and salvaged all of this wonderful material so that people can study it. And we're currently just beginning to develop research projects around the archive. So this is why I say the others have more to say than me, that their research is more developed than mine. I'm going to cut short what I've written because we've seen a lot today and people probably are processing a lot and would like to say something, so we're keen to hear from you. But just to say a couple of things about the kind of research that we hope that the archive might make possible. One of the premises of this research, of course, is that Dwoskin's work is not as well known as it should be. But also that perhaps that some of the reasons why this might be so are interesting in themselves. Art history, like any other form of history, tends to erase the less trodden paths, smoothing over non-conformity. Archival work can reopen these paths and the possibilities that they lead to. One of the most exciting aspects of the archive from our point of view is that it enables younger researchers of maybe another generation to connect with the work of Dwoskin, which they might not know anything about initially, and to make connections between the work and the current moment. But we are also equally interested in the possibility that the broader community of people who knew and worked with Dwoskin might also bring their knowledge to bear and share their views as research into the archive is ongoing. Under Rachel Garfield's leadership then, several projects have already come out of the archive, including two PhDs which are in progress, one of which is Dara's, based on archival research and curatorial practice, and the other practice-based PhD being conducted by Philomen Howell. There's also been a dossier published in the journal Screen in the spring of 2016 with contributions by Rachel, Henry, Lucy Reynolds, Adrian Martin and Dan Kidner. So the people here today then bring a variety of different perspectives on Dwoskin's work with differing degrees of familiarity. Rachel was a close friend and was influenced by him as a young filmmaker. She's interested in approaching his work as subjective film and video and in fostering creative work with the archive. Henry's approach to the archive is that of a cultural historian. His article in the Screen dossier explored connections and comparisons with Raymond Durnyat and through these the cultural politics of a particular historical moment. Jenny is a phenomenological film theorist interested in the ways that bodies and embodiment shape cinematic experience, which we can see as an important theme in Dwoskin's work with regard both to his own body and those of others. And finally, Dara's research explores ways of understanding Dwoskin's self-representation through his diverse cultural interests and complex personal identity. So I guess it's my job to ask the first question and to encourage people to jump in. And I suppose linking from the question of the archive, I'm tempted to say that Trying to Kiss the Moon is a kind of archival autobiography, that Dwoskin seems to approach his own life story as a sort of archive, or through the archive of his films. And in a way it's quite indirect that he begins with someone other than himself. He begins with Robert Kramer. And the film is full of all of these other people. So I wonder if the panel would like to respond to this rather displaced approach that the film takes as an autobiography.
In a sense, it's a kind of self-hiding, I think, that's going on in a lot of the film, as you mentioned, Alison, with the opening, which comes from the video letters between Robert Kramer and Stephen Dworkin. So actually there's an opening from someone else, and then one of the very early sequences of in the film, and Trying to Kiss the Moon, of Dworkin as an adult, I noticed as I was watching it, it's a fairly short segment, and it looks like he's on perhaps on holiday, and he's batting the camera away. And then the next part of the sequence, so the camera pans, and then the next part of the sequence is that he's actually holding up a newspaper of the death of Franco, but I thought he was holding up the newspaper because of the death of Franco, but actually he's holding up the newspaper to cover his face. So there's lots of kind of sort of refusals and coverings over of the self, sort of a layering over with different forms of history as well. And maybe that's speaking to something about the sort of the relationship of the personal work and the archive's relationship to history, film history, and political history too. It also makes me think of, Dara, something that you were saying earlier about, you had a quotation, I think, from a different film from about Dirty, is that right?
And yeah. Will I read about it?
Yeah.
This is a quotation. The dirt marks, the grainy texture of the image, and the breakdown of the continuity of action give the whole film the quality of a highly charged erotic memory. This creates the effect of a dreamlike recalling of a scene with the dreamer's freedom to rerun or pause on particular gestures and freeze certain privileged moments, such as the caress of a hand, the bounce of a breast, a play with sensual images retained from a scene witnessed some time in the past.
We should say that Dirty is a film which is refilmed, right? It is a film which he's shot in the mid-60s, and then the result that we call Dirty is a result, is a product of...
It's a 1971 reshooting of a 1965 film.
Has it been refilmed off the screen?
Yeah, though?
Yeah, that's what I mean. So it is. It's sort of engaging with that, the texture of the thing, in the first place. Yes.
Because this is his words that you just read out.
These are the words of John Duquesne, who was a member of the London Filmmakers Co-op, and it was the time Dirty was exhibited in Gallery House. But I think what's interesting about it is that while that description fits a lot of what he does in Trying to Kiss the Moon, and especially a lot of the later autobiographical films like Mom and Dad, it's actually a description of a film that is of two women engaging in erotic play on a bed. And I think one of the misleading things about Trying to Kiss the Moon and calling it an autobiographical film is that it suggests that it's kind of a new departure, or maybe it's a singular item in Dworkin's career, but what he's actually doing in the film is something he's always been interested in. Although there's this false opposition created in kind of avant-garde British film history between sort of Dworkin's kind of filmmaking and structuralist material filmmaking, he was actually very much passionately engaged with certainly the materialist side of filmmaking. A lot of his early films were shot in New York. They have two dates. They were shot in New York, but then when he brought the cans over to America, they were given soundtracks by people like Ron Geeson and Gavin Bryars. A film like Sea Film is a film of two halves. It's a film, it's a bit like Chinese Checkers that we saw in the documentary. It's a film of two women engaging in play. And then in the second, it's the two women commenting on that film. So he's always engaged with this idea of film as this repository of memory and something that's looked back, that is being looked back on in the past. So even if it doesn't have an autobiographical content from his point of view, he sees it as central to the idea of film. And where I think it develops in this is there's a link between film as something that records the past and film as a technology, as a fragile mm-hmm. technology. So we see film breaking down, we see video and that idea of ghosting, where you see video is breaking down and you see kind of ghosts of images appearing, and he's using that metaphorically to talk about the haunting of the past and how it's captured in technology, I think.
But also the fragility of the body.
Yeah.
I mean, throughout the film, there's this idea of falling down. You know, there's lots of legs and people fall down. Obviously, his own fragility as well is and the poignancy of him walking and not walking, and the woman's leg, and, you know, his grandfather falling down, and him, and it kind of always strikes me when I see this film how there's a shot of him walking as a toddler, mm-hmm. and the kind of difficulty of walking as a toddler, and in a way that the way that he's walking as a toddler is not unlike the way that he walked when he was on crutches. So this kind of,
yeah.
it's almost like the kind of repetition of movement and the way that life repeats. Mm. And this kind of repetition was also, I think, reflected in, you know, the views out the window. So I think it's not just about the past, it's about the way that the past replays in the present and how you kind of look at it from the present into the past and how you read into the past and how that reframes the past as well.
I think that particularly takes place in terms of gesture. So you were talking about the kind of the very strange sort of embodied repetitions of a toddler walking and Doskin walking with calipers and crutches, and these sort of there's a similarity, but it's not an absolute sort of replica in any way. And it seems like I almost think about the Trying to Kiss the Moon as a kind of a repertoire or an encyclopedia of gesture. Gestures to do with walking, to do with falling, to do with smiling, to do with oblique looking, to do with a multitude of macro and micro expressions of the face, but also to do with movement.
Mm.
And I think there seems to be quite a tension in Trying to Kiss the Moon between Doskin's body as the camera wielder and images of his body.
Mm.
And that seems to be the thing that really, really struck me was the sequence that's taken from the Lacette interview, the French interview with Doskin. And he's full frame, and some of the there's no subtitles, but some of the murmurings in the background are to do with so the I think the director is speaking to the director of photography, asking the camera person to slightly expand the frame so that Doskin's hands become visible, but actually the whole of his hands don't become visible. It's just so there's just enough to see the micro gestures of the hand, I suppose, as I'm doing now. Just enough. But in doing so, what it does is it draws attention to the fact that it's Doskin's body being framed as an object of regard. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that particular segment of the film, of the interview, is used in Trying to Kiss the Moon, and that it cuts off pretty much the moment at which Doskin begins to speak. So the moment at which he actually starts articulating his own position, that is the point at which it's cut off. And that seems to me like such a subtle and multi-layered way of talking about subjectivity, subject positions, when bodies are framed, when Doskin's own body's framed, when the women in his films are framed, and the ethical discomfort that's always within that. And I think it seems to be quite a gentle way of talking about something that's ultimately incredibly intrusive.
Are we allowed to interrupt and ask questions?
Yes,
because
of course.
In that sequence, then he didn't appear to understand the original French, and then they re-said it in some slightly different way.
Oh, sorry, could you speak up a little?
Sorry, it was when the first question in French,
yeah.
that he didn't appear to understand that. I don't know if he understands French, but then when they re-spoke it, okay. they said it in different ways, and
yes.
it was different, slightly different
yes.
questions. And it was really interesting how the
yeah.
French... So the people speaking French obviously understand French, but then they rephrase the question
yeah.
in some quite different way.
Did you hear? Do you want us to repeat the question or the comment? Okay.
I think it's really interesting that it's not subtitled. I think also the sound layering in that particular segment is fascinating, because even in the French, there are some parts that are murmured and some parts that are articulated quite clearly. There's some closer to the mic, there's some further away. And as you quite rightly pointed out, there are lots of sort of reframings of the same question, which is about the relationship between Dawson's filmmaking and disability.
But that's like a microcosm of the whole film, isn't it? And that's where, so much of it is about kind of the smoke and mirrors of representation and power and, looks and questions about ontology, and so it's almost like it's all crystallized in that moment, which is interesting because it's really focused on him as the object, especially when there has been so much debate and discussion about the way he may objectify women. And here he is, making sure that he's objectified as well.
And the tripping up, it is partly linguistic, because the translator says, oh, I've just tripped myself up, I don't know how to phrase this question, because it's a multi-part question. One is about a filmmaking career and the other is about being an artist who lives with impairments. And I think when the question is broken down and translated, what it seems to show is actually how that question doesn't really work. It's not really an effective question to ask somebody about their entire oeuvre and then to try and subsume it within one element of their physicality and their body. So it seems that it's something about language, but also something about the image, and something about how it isn't comfortable or possible or even reasonable to try and place everything that an artist does and an artist's work within this sort of frame of disability. So it just comes apart.
Thinking about this question of Dworkin's body and Dworkin's attitude to bodies, one of the things I wonder, just thinking about the fact that the film is full of other people who aren't him, I wonder what the status of the young Dworkin as a child in his father's home movie footage is. Is that in what would we say about the way that he looks at himself? Maybe particularly in the images before he had polio, that right early in the film, that moment when he gets out of the hammock and stands up is incredibly affecting, precisely because of what you were saying, Rachel, about the way we read from the present back into the past. My question is that a childhood body effectively someone else, and what's his attitude to that person? But also there may be other things that people want to say about that really interesting footage.
Can I ask a question linked to that? Sorry. Just because there's a load of stuff of him running around or trotting or staggering about as a small child, and then there's a load of stuff of him as an adult. But there's this one bit with the hospital scene, and so I was kind of thinking, where's the transition here? Because this must have been really shocking for the family and for him and so on. And so there's just a kind of like vaguely shadowy thing of which has got him as an adult and him as a child in the same. And it seems to be multiple versions in this hospital scene. And I was, can you add that into your question, please?
I guess it's the site of trauma, isn't it? The silence of trauma. I mean, I find that pan in the hospital, I find incredibly moving and poignant. And the other thing that has really struck me is that a lot of the footage that his father, presumably father, and sometimes his mother, I guess, I don't know, people shot, remains in silence. The mic, some of it has the violin and a lot of it's in silence, and I feel that is also a silence of trauma as well, and it's really shadowy, it's very unclear. So that's how, and like you could imagine that his life probably, his perception of his life was to do with being on either side of that. And so this bouncing back and forth between these different states of being, I think, is quite significant.
There was something else I was going to say, I forgot.
Sorry.
I mean, a couple of years before Steve died, I just did a couple of voice recordings starting from his early life, and he spoke about hospital. He was finding it difficult to speak because his lungs weren't in a very good condition, and he was already kind of breathing through a mask a lot of the time. But it seemed that hospital period was an incredibly traumatic one, partly because he was moved to a hospital where his parents could hardly get to, only very seldom. So it was a time of great loneliness for him. He was by himself a lot of the time.
It was quite brutal as well, wasn't it, from what he told me?
I'm just trying to kind of recall.
I mean, he told me that there were a lot of, Anthony and Ian might also recall, but there were a lot of veterans from Korea there, and they used to fling themselves off the roof because they couldn't bear the thought of living in a wheelchair. These were young men who were looking forward to a life. and that vision of their future life had been, irrevocably damaged. And so a lot of them, and he also talked to me about having these kind of wheelchair fights, really brutal wheelchair fights with other children in the hospital. So, yeah, so I think it was quite, aside from the trauma of, his bodily dysfunction, there was also how hard the life was in the hospital as well. I think so, and as you say,
and so there was this great loneliness, and he built great resilience within himself and read a lot. And he talked a little bit about the films that he used to show in one of the hospitals, But I've seen, trying to catch them a couple of times or more, but it was only this time that I remembered I saw that short clip that you mentioned in, the images from the actual hospital ward. And I think that is kind of a silenced part of his life that perhaps he's, I don't know, but it appears in a very, he doesn't dwell on the hospital, and that is kind of cut out, but also inserted in that, maybe it was only very little, there wasn't any more image that was available.
Yeah, it could be as prosaic as that.
Absolutely.
There was that shot of him getting into a car and balancing his crutches on the side of the car. One falls over. And I think that may have been when he was leaving the hospital. That shot is held for quite a long time.
And that also, seeing the crutch fall over, linked up with the bodies falling over as well. That was very poignant, I thought, that shot. Yeah.
I mean, I do also wonder whether there's a way of sort of looking at the film that doesn't forget the personal and doesn't try to sideline it, but also maybe allows the film to sit as a film which is not solely an archive of Toskin as a person, but also a way of thinking about the film's relationship to art film. To experimental filmmaking, to structural and materialist filmmaking, as we've discussed. And I'm just wondering that, it was a film that was commissioned for Channel 4 and the Arts Council, is that right?
Mm.
Mm. And had funding from the Rockefeller Foundation.
Mm. Yeah.
So this is a film that is also, it's also for audiences. And I guess I wonder whether there's also a way that this film is not avoiding talking about illness and impairment and the the difficulties of the environment that failed to adequately account for Dworkin's body's needs as well as everybody's body's needs. But I wonder whether it strikes me that the film isn't consumed with sort of solely concerned with leg braces, crutches and a wheelchair as the dominant modes of movement. So there's lots of different types of movement which are going on in the film which aren't just about those things that can be used as ciphers for physical impairment. And I think there's a very fine and careful balance going on between, on the one hand, acknowledging autobiography and the place of personal history, while also sort of placing it in dialogue with bodies and movements and images and experimental practices. And I find that tension both really interesting and it produces exactly all of these sorts of questions about where's Dworkin in this autobiographical film about Stephen Dworkin.
I would say that's why it qualifies as an essay film, that it is to a degree oblique, that it certainly isn't a straightforward autobiography. I mean, the autobiography is quite a broad genre in the same way that the essay is. I don't know that there is a standard for what an autobiographical film is. But if you compare it with I mentioned earlier, Mikas, who documented a great deal of his life and created sort of compilations of that, it's relatively guileless, I would say, next to Dworkin's work, which has this process of revelation and withdrawal, and also the sort of this much more analytical approach towards the images. Even I think in some instances, certainly when they're going through the photograph album, it's the fact that it is done not alone, that it's with his family members, and especially the two, I think it's two scenes with Trixie, with whom he'd made a film, Trixie, in the late 1960s, and she is commenting on it while it's being superimposed. There are echoes thereof. There's the first section of Anna Ambrose's film and the Sea film. But this idea of commentary, but I mean, it's essayistic, i.e. personal essayistic, in Virginia Woolf's sense, which I wrote down a quote from. Virginia Woolf, who doesn't seem to come up very much in discussion of the essay film, but she does write a fairly canonical essays about the essay. Mm. And anyway, she was writing, saying of a given essayist, "He has brought personality into literature not unconsciously and impurely, but so consciously and purely that we do not know whether there is any relation between the essayist and the man. Never to be yourself and yet always, that is the problem." Mm. I mean, she's actually talking about Max Beerbohm, oddly enough, but it does sort of figure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I well, there's two things that one of which is literature was an abiding presence in his life, and certainly he talked a lot in many different ways to different people about the importance of Ulysses to his mode of practice, and of course Beckett to his mode of practice, So I think that you know, that's quite important. But the other thing that struck me, and you know, has struck me before with his work is, I think it's come to the fore in this piece, is that relationship between painting and the kind of organisation of time, in the way that a painter might organise a rectangle. So the way he edited, I felt, was very much through the feel of the work, the textures, the colours, the rhythms. So although it was very considered in its organisation, it also felt quite intuitive in its organisation as well. And I thought it was really interesting the way that, you know, his paintings were quite prominent in their own way, both by their difference to the filmed and the photographic image, which I'm sure he was thinking about a lot, but also this kind of close-up of the texture of the film and of the paintings and the colour of the paintings, I felt was really interesting in relation to the textures of the photographs and the films, and the way some of the film stock was very kind of painterly and rich, and the way that it was shown. Sometimes, you know, the shadows, it was very kind of soft in places, which I'm sure he knowingly played with. So I think there's the literary and also the painterly.
Organic way of working. I mean, you know, things kind of come about, because I mean, we were involved with it, and there were discussions. You know, we had dinner, and you know, things would be spoken about, and things would be, you know, kind of planned. But it was very organic, the whole thing.
Mm.
And I do think it came out of the new technology of smaller video cameras of high eight, and that, you know, it's that I think led to this more fragmentary structure. Know, because I think that's fairly new for his films. To have a film that's made of fragments in this way, and I do think that came out of using, because he was able to use these very small video cameras. You know, because by that time it was more difficult and obviously much more expensive for him to use 16mm cameras. You know, so there was a kind of fluidity that came in through the use of those small cameras, which I think affected the whole aesthetic of that work and then led into his subsequent work.
Yeah, I see that as quite a transitional film between the digital work and the filmic. There's Ruth.
There's Laura as well.
There was a lady at the back, and then Laura was the next.
I just wanted to ask a question, which was, how old was he when he contracted polio?
11, I think, was it? 10 or 11?
So puberty.
Yeah.
That's tough.
So two massive transitional periods in one. Physically transitional.
He talked in. He produced. You two may know this. He produced a text that fragments of which are in the narrative, and in that text he talks about. This is in the archive. He talks about his grandfather was a dancer, and he talks about how he might have been a dancer, but you know, he also talks about. How that, you know, these kind of young men in the hospital would talk about how, you know, going out dancing with their, you know, women friends and romance through dancing. And he was like, what's this dancing with other people? He said he didn't really understand it because he'd never been through that period where you started to do that, to kind of dance erotically with, you know, the object of your, you know, desire. So for him, dancing was about performing, like his grandfather did. So it's quite interesting, that disconnect that came out of him having lost that use of his legs before he was, you know, before adolescence and before his kind of, you know, adult desire was formed properly. So.
But I really do see those kind of broken transitions in Trying to Kiss the Moon as well, broken transitions between performance and sexuality.
Mm.
And that there seems to be this, especially in the ways that the that his oeuvre is kind of sort of fragmented through the film, it feels like there's so much that is pushing both either in the direction of performance or in the direction of sexuality.
Mm.
Or bringing them together or pulling them apart. And it seems to be, it feels like it's something to do with that tension of dance, the capacity of gesture, choreographed gesture of any form to kind of to move between sexuality and performances of sexuality and back again, and vulnerability to the secondary.
Laura?
Well, I had a specific question for you, Rachel, actually, and then a very general question. Because I was thinking about the title, How to Kiss, Trying to Kiss the Moon, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about the beginning of your essay in Other Cinemas, where you say very specifically, you're introducing the Hindert, but you're introducing mm-hmm. the Broskin work more generally, and you're talking about his cinema as a haptic cinema, mm-hmm. that there's always the desire to touch, to mm-hmm. reach out and touch, but at the same time what you're arguing is that this is ultimately in his cinema impossible. Mm-hmm. So I was just thinking about how Trying to Kiss the Moon as a title just touches precisely on, I mean, this isn't something I thought of, this is something you thought of, mm-hmm. but I just wondered if you might comment on that, because it seemed to me that there was such a close connection between your reading of his films and the title of this particular film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, I think one of the things I was also struck is how he talks about being really shy, but yet there are these constant images of himself.
I just wondered if you could say something about the hapticity.
Oh, the hapticity. Well, in some ways, that's more Jenny's area. But I think to give my own reading of that, I think that He kind of tries to, it looks like he tries to touch people with the camera, you know, the close-up, the way that he caresses what he's looking at with the camera, and how he's interested in beauty, but he's also interested in you know, how can he make that person real? And it's almost like he can only make that person real through the camera, but yet, you know, you can never break through that camera as well. So I think that, in a way, his filmmaking is a sort of metaphor for his feelings about life, really. And he tries to create that in the work. And this, you know, this parading forth of lots of women who he's playing with, trying to kind of touch that kind of desire to be whole with them, I think. Is ultimately repudiated both by them and their performance, and him capturing them through performance, but also through the screen, you know, the camera, the inability to really touch.
A lot of it, I think, is the obverse of something else that is not in the films. Certainly from reading what he says in the late 1960s, he's very mindful of a sort of new media-saturated environment, and as growing up in lots of respects as a normal American boy with abilities who is absorbing Hollywood culture the whole time and feels that this is alienating and that this is producing all the classic kind of modernist critique of popular culture, that it's creating sort of automatic responses and that it is making people act as if they are in movies, etc. That's sort of what the young Dworkin is writing about. And so that his movies that he's making at this moment, like Alone, are supposed to be a kind of great break with that form of cinema and with its typical mode of address, and so that we're alone with these characters, and that there is, I think, supposed to be. I mean, the ideal for him is a breaking through. He realizes that it's unattainable, but the way he writes about it is.
But I think, you know, the trying to kiss the moon, it's about trying to kiss the moon. I think the trying is what matters, and he tries and tries in his films, and, you know, he talks about being alone, but, you know, he also talks about trying to connect. So this kind of paradox, I think he sees as the struggle of life, you know. And I keep trying to kiss the moon also makes me think of that famous Méliès film with the moon, you know. And that every time I say that, I think of that moon in that Méliès film. And I, So I think there's...
He gets his eye
It's about, yeah. It's about fantasy as well.
I think that's a crucial point, because Walden, the Mika's film, is dedicated to Lumiere and that idea of just looking at reality. And Alison said earlier that the film begins with somebody else talking, Robert Kramer, but it's actually Robert Kramer recounting a dream. And one of the important things about this autobiography is that just looking at reality is not enough. Just looking at home movies is not enough. That you need to find a form that can account for dream, fantasy, reality, desire, because the surface will not tell you the whole story. And I think that's what he's trying to do. When he says it's an autobiographical film, it's almost like a sleight of hand, in the sense that it's not going to be a straightforward autobiographical film like the first film we saw, The Anna Ambrose, which is very much a chronological, linear film.
But it's also a film where people describe Dworkin, where there's lots of people. I mean, there's the talking.
They're describing
talking
it in their terms.
But yeah, but it's not necessarily so much. What struck me about the film that we watched earlier, The Cinema of Stephen Dworkin, is that so much of that seems to be not about Dworkin, but about the perceptions of those eminent and important people who are talking about him. And that actually what they're talking about is an inflection of what they feel is most significant or most important about film and film theory and filmmaking at that particular moment. And I think that's really fascinating, that these are individuals who are creating a vision. They're creating an image of Dworkin, just as Dworkin is also creating images of himself. So the two films together almost seem like they're mirror pairs of one another. I think that's really fascinating.
I do wonder, and I think I may have got this idea from you, Rachel, if actually the paradox is even deeper, that Dworkin's strategy for trying to get close to people actually produces distance, and which is why you get the Paul Willimon argument about the fourth look and critical distance. So it's not only paradoxical, also ironic, really, that which, you know, has to do with the constructions of sexuality that we're born into, you know, that he was born into a particular construction, and this is a way of working with that, but ironically can't work.
Just kind of linked into what you just said, because, I mean, you're just talking about he was concerned about details.
Could you speak
right?
up a little?
I'm sorry. It's just linked to what you just said, because you were just commenting that he was concerned about seeing depersonalisation and so on. But really, the women in his films, he's got young, beautiful women who are looked at and who perform for him, and I don't see how he's really getting close to anybody in this. I felt really concerned about that. Just continued to go there. These women are just to be looked at and to perform, and they're not really. There's one woman who's having a conversation with him about the thing about how he doesn't really like her apartment because he's nothing to see looking out of the windows.
Well, there's a woman towards. I mean, there are. They're not. A, they're not all young, and B, they're not all performing. And I think there is a wide array of women there, as well as some men. I think that maybe we notice. I don't know. You know, they weren't all. I don't know whatever good looking is. I don't know.
There's a range of appearances and ages.
Yeah.
They're not all some sort of ideal fetish woman of his conception, because if they were, they would all look a lot more similar to each other than they do.
Well, they're also very, very much not kind of a Hollywood ideal of the fantasy as well. So there's a person with a red jumper who wants to talk.
I was wondering about. I was going to ask whether what his kind of response was in words to the critique of his gaze, because perhaps because I'd just seen a documentary beforehand, I kind of read the whole film as being actually like a justification or at least an explanation of his gaze, because it was always looking, and because there were so many different women and. Because the early footage that he was showing was always showing him kissing one of his siblings. It's very affectionate. So it seemed to kind of, that image seemed to kind of draw this thread through the thing as a kind of an autobiography of a gaze. an explanation of a gaze through time, which actually would, for me, fits in quite well with that period and the mixing of media, because one media looking at another medium is a way of looking at a gaze. And I think Hans Bertin writes about this period as being about the preservation of the gaze. So as an artist filmmaker, and I see it as an artist film rather than an essay film or a documentary, it seems to me that it's like a whole autobiography of the gaze. This is how I've looked at the world all my life. But I don't know, I mean, did he actually respond in words to the critique of his gaze? Did he say it wasn't?
He,
sexualized gaze or
I mean, I can only talk from, and I'm sure other people who knew him could also chip in. I can only say what he said to me was he felt it was a very, that the critiques of the gaze that were used in to critique or criticise his films, he felt were very reductive, and didn't take into account the kind of the rich range of experiences that his he felt his films explored. Obviously, this film, by its own admission in his narrative, says it's about, you know, experiencing the world through his eyes, you know, through his being. How did he see the world? What was it like being him? But that, you know, I think he felt the people who launched that critique were kind of just hadn't really looked at his work. So I don't know whether
way of making films as a result.
Laura's got her hand up.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on that. I asked you whether, when you see the film, try to make a note that rather than it being an exploration of all these different things, it's using all these different things as it were, traces, documents, to try and figure out how he ended up the way he did.
Yeah.
So it's as though, just to get back to Henry's point about the essayistic, it's not so much content driven as investigatively driven.
Mm.
Who am I and why am I like this? But at the same time slightly detached from the I-ness, because he can actually put himself slightly at a distance from himself. So how did this person, how did this person, artist, end up the way he did, doing the things he did? So I was thinking of it more as a kind of investigation rather than as a record, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered what you felt about that.
Yeah,
well,
I agree.
Well, it's such, you know, it's almost an historically unique position for somebody of his age that his memories are incarnated as home movies.
Mm.
I think it's kind of surprising. I mean, I don't know that much about his background, but there's such a wealth of home movies from, I think, and not particularly well-off family from Brooklyn.
No, his father was in the garment industry, and his father was a presser. So, so they weren't.
And he only discovered them late.
And so these. So as you say, it's an investigation, but with these sorts of documents that somebody 20 years older than him would not have.
There's something to do with what you were saying, but there's something to do with the integrative processes of reintegrating lots of different types of fragments. I think it was when you were talking about the eye and being able to set the eye apart in order to scrutinise or examine that eye. Mm-hmm. And that made me think about the ways in which there are lots of sort of, I suppose we could call them states of consciousness, which do that. Both as responses to trauma, like dissociation, for example, and also as kind of a process of analysis and an attempt to integrate lots of fragmented parts of one's history and self-identity and self-representation and representation of self, sounds like maybe some of the work that this film is doing.
Lady at the back.
I think, you know, you said that he was from an ordinary American, had an ordinary American boyhood. He was born in 1939. He's Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of Jewish families did a lot of cine camera documentation. Mm. And I think that sort of doesn't often come into the discussion about Steve Jostin. I don't know if your essay has.
No, it doesn't really. And in fact, Dara's thinking quite a lot about Steve's Jewishness, and that was one of the ways in which me and Steve did actually form a connection, was through the Jewishness, as I know a couple of other Jewish women here would probably might say the same thing. I think there was also very much an awareness of that generation, his parents' generation, of the disappearance of so many Jews in Europe.
And was a real hype around 1940 in the US.
But also his grandfather, you see, was a dancer and drew, so his grandfather was engaged in the cultural life, and his grandfather was in the Odessa uprising. You know, so I think there was a particular connection to history, and that maybe, you know, meant that that kind of idea of commentating through the camera might not have been so strange. I don't know.
I just wondered, because it was a very earnest and quite emotional way of talking about his work here. I didn't know him personally, and I don't know so many of the films. We've talked a lot about trauma, and the word poignant has come up very often, and there is a certain sort of tenor that relates to disability discourse that can adopt that sort of language. Mm. I just wondered, and when we're talking about Kissing the Moon, it sounds wonderful, but Kissing the Moon, there's no air, it's cold and it's dusty. Who would want to kiss the moon? And I just wondered, because when we were also talking about the French interview, the main response here was to laugh. Mm.
Yeah.
Because at the point when he then just said, it's a complex question, and cut. And I just wonder whether there's something a bit more subversive, possibly even a bit lighter than we're suggesting here about this, and also slightly more comic in a certain sense. And there's even an element of self-deprecation in there sometimes.
Oh,
like, because in that sense, you can't kiss the bloody moon. So, you know, trying to get close to people, if that's the metaphor, you've had it from the start, really.
Yeah, one of the things I like is his deflation. But that tension between tragedy and comedy, I think, is very present in his work. Mm. So, Anthony,
Well, just to say, I agree with what Martin says, and that, you know, having worked with him on the film, and I remember when we put that French interview in, and it was primarily kind of for its humour. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way it does cut, and the way the guy kind of, when he asks the question, he gets lost and can't remember, you know, and that's what I remember, and obviously Steve sitting there for a long time with nothing happening.
Yeah. It's brilliant comic timing.
Mm-hmm.
A comic timing in editing as well. That's fantastic rhythm. He did have
quite a wit, didn't he, in, you know, as a person.
I don't think these two things are opposed at all. There's no reason why it wouldn't be. And
I'd also say about the footage, you know, the standard 8 footage, that, I mean, that was a discovery for him then, because the films weren't played, you know, because they were unplayable, really.
Mm.
They were very, very damaged and delicate, and that's why they're sort of out of focus. They came in and out of focus, the film. You know, I transferred them, and so that was the first time that he'd seen them since his childhood, at least. You know, when we transferred them for the film, and that was during the film as well. So, you know, I think that goes back to this organic thing. There wasn't, you know, any prescribed structure that he learned. That's if you comment more on the editing. But as far as I remember, there wasn't any prescribed kind of structure for the film. It evolved organically when all these elements came together.
Mm.
You know. So it's a series of ideas. I mean, you know, maybe in a similar way to Outside In, you know, it's a similar a sequence of ideas. I mean, the idea of the woman running between the paintings, for example. I mean, I was involved with the filming of that. I shot some shots of Steve filming in that sequence. So that was one idea within the film. Similarly, the woman, that memory from crossing the Atlantic, and the woman dancing on the deck. I mean, that was something we set up. It was just one idea, and then a number of ideas that then came together organically. And
so
I'm sure kind of changed in the editing.
Can we ask you then about that footage, seeing as you transferred it, so you would have seen it firsthand? Did Steve manipulate any of that footage, or was it as his father had shot?
It was that. I mean, maybe some of it is slowed down.
Yeah.
But other than that, no, it was as it was shot, yeah.
Okay.
It's just that some of it, you know, was quite bad quality, you know, so he didn't enhance that bad quality. That's how it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
What proportion of the footage is used? I mean, was there loads more that wasn't used?
Yeah, I would say there's quite a bit more.
Yeah. So he chose to use those bits?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, there's quite an interesting relationship between his footage you know, his footage and his father's footage, or his, you know, this kind of, yeah, this dialogue, and it was just interesting because he talks in the beginning about the younger generation and you becoming stuck in your own generation, but yet there's this dialogue, this intergenerational dialogue between his father's generation or his father and himself, which I think is quite interesting, you know.
I don't want to be facetious, but just in response to that gentleman, there is footage early on where Fran Forches is filming Lady's Bottom, so I wonder, is that another meaning of mood that we should consider?
It's possible.
I don't know what you think, but I mean, he does, us being you know, from his generational position, which he kind of acknowledges, when you look at you know, some of the, you know, the 60s films, you know, which are, there's a certain amount of flower power and you know, overt sexuality going on in quite a lot of them, and you know, remembering or thinking about his experience, which must have been really important for him in America, you know, being friends with, you know, Warhol, and having access to all that kind of very, you know, kind of hot material, and then, you know, seeing, you know, so trying to kiss the moon seems to me, kind of subjectively, to be, you know, a part, each, all the different elements of his life, including his paintings, get, you know, become part of this kind of montage, this collage, this point of contact that is explored in the film, but. You know, back to the kind of the Warholian kind of aesthetic, which perhaps, you know, the paintings remind me of, and I don't know when they were made, but I think that they were quite, were they from the 60s?
No, they were later on. They were I'm not sure, they were painted fairly early on.
I think some of them might have been. I think some of them might have been exhibited in 1969 at the ICA, where it's certainly similar style.
Yeah, I think, yeah, Bobby might know.
When the paintings were from.
He stopped painting, he didn't continue to
paint. Oh, yeah,
they're paint.
From the mid-60s, or 68, because we saw some recently and they had...
Oh, that's right, yes, he did.
He had 66 and 68 written on the back of them.
Yeah.
Some of them are in the film.
He showed his films sort of in galleries with his paintings. They're quite integral.
But it's interesting that he didn't continue painting, but... You know, there's constant like reference, you know, that goes back to the paintings. Mm-hmm. Maybe physically you found that more difficult, or maybe there wasn't the need for it, but the aesthetic.
They didn't sell them.
I don't think. I have such a lot of interesting questions around the various components of his life and his, you know, what he produced in during his life.
I was just going to say something about the time, but you carry on.
No, I know there's a lady with a question next to Ruth, so perhaps I should hand over the floor.
I don't really come from a film background, so this but I was just thinking more in relation to the research that I am doing. She's a member of the club for a very short amount of time. And it kind of relates to the idea of painting. So her relationship to painting is that she was a painter and then she expanded into performance, also filmmaking. And so I just felt like there is a resonance with the kind of ideas that were prevalent around the late 60s into the early 70s in relation to the work of William Wright or Artaud, and the relationship then to the Muse and Seine.
Yeah.
I mean, she travelled. She was over here in 67, and we looked into this a bit recently about
She was in one of his films.
She was in one of his films. Yeah. She was in Times 4 in the early 70s.
So me and Darrell talked about this because me and Darrell based at Tate.
Okay. Do you know how far back did they know each other back in New York before he came over? Do you know?
I don't. I've not found anything. I didn't know that Dawson painted, you see, so I was thinking about the relationship between how she incorporated painting, her own painting, into environments within her performative work in the 60s in New York.
Oh, if you look at
that stuff is then reconfigured in her film work that she's then editing when she's in London. And well, she combines all these moments and these modes within all that kind of.
You should see Take Me, because that's
a really rather banal point, that the arrival of the 60mm camera, non-sync, was an absolutely enormous explosion at the time. So you have to think of it as something that was comparatively new and exciting that people picked up, whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say Yvonne Rainer as a dancer, Karen Sheeman's performance artist, you know, painters. Suddenly, the arrival of these cameras was
And it allowed for that kind of movement that
between and across and documentation, exploring completely new ways of seeing.
And this whole the way that it was multimedia, that, I mean, Carolee Schneeman did a multimedia show at the Roundhouse in 67, which Droskin was certainly involved in. And our last panel performance a few months ago was about this very theme on the sort of intermediality of it all. And Droskin also did happenings and performance in front of the film and so on and so forth.
And his film Take Me was
was also like a
it was very like Carolee Schneeman's, wasn't it, with the painting of the body. He was also really engaged with Arto as well.
Yeah,
so
this
I think
idea of immediacy, I just thought was really the films that were shown today. Just trying to get a handle on like who he was influenced by and who he was in dialogue with.
I think
certainly with her.
I'd like to, it'd be good to interview her about her, you know, when she worked on Times 4 with him, and you know, I don't know. Did you know? You didn't. That was before you knew Steve, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think we really have to draw things to a close there, or Michael will get in trouble. So thank you very much to
everybody.
Thank you. I just wanted to underline the fact that, I mean, one of the reasons why it's not a problem to stop is that this isn't as if this is the end of the show. So, I mean, you guys are working on a very long-term, deep project. And as I said to you before, Rachel, you know, in our previous conversations, you know, you're very welcome to do another and another and another.
Well, there's
For me, it's an open-ended series of events that we can do. So that's one of the reasons why I don't think we have to be too concerned about the fact that we're trying to six that. But I would ask people to actually now physically we actually have to close the building. Reasonably soon.
About six minutes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
That was great.